My castaway this week is an actress. With her booming voice and imposing figure, she's become one of Britain's favourite battle axes, the embodiment of the tyrannical mother-in-law. When she began in Rep, she wanted to be a glamorous star, but her performances as Mrs. Hornet in Sailor Beware in the mid-50s, followed by her role as the fierce wife in ITV's The Larkins, set her on the course for which she's famous. In a long string of plays, films and television appearances, including highly successful stints at the National Theatre and the RSC, she's played the part of the Barker reluctant to bite, from the nurse in Romeo and Juliet to the headmistress in The Happiest Days of Your Life. It's earned her the OBE and the affection of millions. You are, she says, only as good as your parts. She is Peggy Mount. But you've had some terrific parts, Peggy. The mass of people will, of course, remember you for Ma Larkin on the television. She was the archetypal battle axe, really, wasn't she?
She was indeed. And when it all happened, I turned it down. I said, no, I'm not going to be typed, because it came after Sailor Beware. And then I read it, and, of course, it was so wonderfully written, I couldn't resist it.
But why do you think... It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, she was an old battle axe, Ada Larkin. Why do you think we loved her so much? Because we did.
Well, all of them really have a heart of gold underneath, and all they're doing it for... I mean, they're bullying their husbands because they don't want their daughters to go through what they've gone through. I mean, it was in both of them. She was for the family. I mean, the husband in Sailor Beware was an absolute horror. I mean, he didn't achieve anything. And so she had to do all the work and all the hard graft, and my daughter's not having that happen to her.
So do you think the audience was women, really? Women kind of... It's a kind of feminism, I suppose, early form of feminism, you know, putting the man in his place and holding the family together and all that stuff.
Oh, I don't know. The men were wonderful. I mean, I had a fantastic moment. I got in a taxi, and I was very busy looking at a script, and he stopped the taxi at the top of Baker Street and said to me, "I do know your name, don't I, lady? Who are you?" And I said, "Peggy Mount." He said, "I knew it. I knew it. But I didn't like to insult you by saying so."
But The Larkins was, well, I presume, one of the very first television sitcoms, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes, we were with, I think it was Joan and Leslie and The Larkins that were the very first.
So it was live?
It
done
was,
live.
To start with, we were live. Oh, dear, yes, we were live.
With an audience?
With an audience. And once, in my experience, we did it without an audience, and you cannot do situation comedy without an audience.
Mm. How many series did you do altogether?
Oh,
with
we
Larkins?
Did an awful lot, didn't we? We did The Larkins for something like 7 years.
Good heavens. And you would have been, I think, in your early 40s when
yes.
you first started doing... And yet, it was the battle axe, wasn't it? You were typecast as the battle axe.
Oh, yes, yes.
But from a long and distinguished line of them, really, if you think about it. I mean, going back to who would you put in that line? Edith Evans, certainly. Margaret Rutherford?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm always hand in hand with Margaret on everything. I mean, everything I do. I mean, I've just practically lived Madame Arcati. And wherever I go, it's always, of course, Margaret Rutherford was the first... The parts I've played have been very varied. I've been very, very fortunate in that way. They offered me a fortune to advertise things as a tough, and I wouldn't do it. I was far more interested in becoming an actress of note than making a lot of money.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, I've always loved Crosby and adored Frank Sinatra. I mean, I think he's one of the greatest. And I think a piece of music that has given a great deal of joy to all of us is What a Swell Party This Is from High Society.
I have heard among this clan you are called a forgotten man.
Is that what they're saying?
Well, did you ever?
What a swell party this is.
And have you heard the story of a boy, a girl, unrequited love?
Sounds like pure soap opera.
I may cry.
Tune in tomorrow.
What a swell party this is.
Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and Well Did You Ever from High Society. Tell me then, Peggy Mount, about this slender glamour puss you believed you could be. What made you think she could exist?
Well, I thought if I slimmed down enough and I was a good enough actress, I could play all the glamour roles. When you think of everything that Coward has written, I would love to... I mean, I did play Hay Fever in Rep. I was totally wrong for it and I wasn't very good. But those were the parts I would love to have played.
So did you starve yourself? I mean, do you think...
Oh, yes. You know, I used to have an apple for lunch and a pear to go to bed with, you know, hoping I would lose weight. And I would lose a stone. And then I'd go back onto my normal diet and I would put it all back on again in a month.
But had you been particularly feminine and petite as a child? Did you have reason to believe that there was somebody...
No. And always, as a little girl, all I wanted to do as a little girl was to be an actress or be a dancer. And I knew if I was too fat, I would never be a dancer. And I suppose it stayed in my mind.
And you had an older sister, didn't you? And you lived very much in her shadow, I think.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I haven't seen her for years. But that wasn't what made me want to be slim. I just wanted to play all these wonderful, glamorous roles.
I just wonder where you got that ambition or that sense of competition from. Or was it perhaps, you know, you were compared to her too much.
I was very much as when I was little.
What did your parents think of you?
Well, my father was an invalid. He was a very, very, very sick man. And he died when I was 11. And I sort of never really knew him as well as I would like to, because he was such a sick man. And I never had any contact with my mother. I mean, my mother didn't like me particularly. I mean, I had no love from her at all.
Why not?
I don't know. I think, you know, it was my brilliant sister who was going to go to the top of the tree and all that sort of thing. And she was a brilliant pianist.
Mm.
So
you had a sort of inferiority complex?
Oh, I had a shocking inferiority complex. Always have had, in that sense. But never about my work, strangely enough.
Mm. But what about your sister? Have you never...
No, I've never really kept in contact with her. I mean, I've got a little thing in my kitchen. God gives us our relations, thank God we can choose our friends.
But you'd had a terrible accident as a small girl, hadn't you?
Yes, when I say a terrible accident, I was always afraid of the dark. I don't know why. And one winter evening, we had a fire and a kettle boiling on it. My sister went out to get some coal, and I locked the door after her, turned round and knocked the kettle over me, and it was boiling, and all the boiling water went into my water boots. And I must have rubbed my leg, and the dye from my brown woolen stockings went in, and it was poisoned, and it was very nasty, and the doctor wanted to amputate. And there was a wonderful Scottish nurse, and she said, "You're too fond of taking people's limbs off. I will save it." And she came in three times a day and put hot fomentations on my leg and saved my leg. But what did happen to me, you know, I went to bed with that bad leg, a little fragile... My dad used to call me his little fragile child, and I got out of bed fat. It shocked all my glands. It must have done.
How did your mother react in all of this?
I don't really remember. I had nothing in common with my mother at all. I wouldn't know what it was to have an arm round me and be loved from my mother.
And how much has that affected you through your
life? I don't think it's affected me greatly. I was very fortunate in that sense that it didn't embitter me. I think going, as I did, into rep with that wonderful fellowship you had in weekly rep, you had to have it, because to put a play on in a week, when you think about it, is almost impossible.
So that became your family, really?
In a funny sort of way, yes.
Mm. Tell me about record number two.
When I was a little girl, I used to black my face up and sing a song, and it was my curly-headed babby, and it was Paul Robeson, of course, his famous, wonderful number.
Oh, my baby, my curly-headed baby, we'll sit below the sky and sing a song to the moon.
Paul Robeson and My Curly-Headed Baby. So you spent your childhood, Peggy Mount, in Southend, longing to be on the stage. Did you always have the voice then?
No, indeed not. All my time in rep, I had the most beautiful contralto velvety voice, but doing 3 years in the play in the West End and going over that audience, of course you had to, you couldn't let them go, 1,500 people all laughing their heads off. I had to go over the top of them, and of course I finished that with a very rough voice.
So, and it just stayed that way, it got deeper and deeper.
Well, it got rougher and rougher, if you know what I mean.
But obviously in Southend you were in amateur dramatics, because you...
Oh yes, I was the queen of the amateurs.
Were you? And did you have a lot of encouragement? I mean...
Well, yes, looking back in those days, I mean, I had a wonderful childhood because everybody was so terribly kind. And because my dad was so sick, and the church were wonderful to me, and I ran the amateurs. And Harry Hansen had a company down there, and one day I went to have a cup of coffee, and sitting opposite me was the director of the company. I mean, I could have fainted, I was so excited, you know, and he came over to me. And he said to me, I understand you want to go on the stage. And I said, yes. He said, well, write to Harry Hansen and they'll give you a job. And he walked out, and that's how I got on.
And so he gave you a job, and off you went to... Where did you send
to
you?
Keighley in Yorkshire.
What, to the Hippodrome?
To the Hippodrome, that was, of course, the... Oh, it was a lovely little theatre, and we did twice weekly, twice nightly there. And that is now a bus stop, sadly. It was a lovely little theatre, a beautiful little theatre.
But what sort of plays did you do?
Oh, we did all of them. I mean, we did Blithe Spirit and... because I can remember playing the maid in Blithe Spirit when I was very young and tripping, and I had a tray of tea and cup, and it went all over the stage because I went flat on my face.
How much did you get paid?
I was paid £4 a week, and £2.10 had to go on my digs, not full board, bed and breakfast for £2.10, and then the other 30 shillings one, you know, had to live on.
And two performances a day?
Twice a day, twice nightly. But, of course, to me, it was the West End of London. I mean, nothing was more wonderful than Keighley Hippodrome.
And the first time you'd been out of Southend, was it?
First time I'd... I mean, because when I got to Keighley that night, that the stage direct was supposed to meet me, and it was a Sunday night, and it was pouring with rain. And when I got to the theatre, there was nobody there at all. And I thought, what am I going to do? And somebody said, are you in trouble, love? And I said, I told him, and he said, oh, come over here, he said. I'll introduce you to Maud Waller-Shillock after. And he took me into a pub, and I'd never been in a pub in my life. I'd signed the pledge and all that, you know.
Good Methodist, you know.
Absolutely. And they all said to me, what are you going to have to drink? And all I knew was shandy. And they lined up, I mean, there was shandy everywhere, and somebody said, hey, by gum, if you eat that lot, she said, you'll bust your navel. And I was known as the navel buster up there after that.
Tell me about your next piece of music.
Having played Blithe Spirit several times, of course, there is always... It runs right the way through the play, and it'll always be very close to my heart. And I think you've got Elizabeth Welsh doing it. How wonderful.
I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand always, always.
Days may... Elizabeth Welsh singing Always. From Blithe Spirit. How many times have you played?
Oh, for goodness sake, I've played it for the last 10 or 15, 20 years. It's followed me. It's a lovely, wonderful, fabulous part.
Mm. You played it, I think, about 6 or 7 years ago at the Lyric Hammersmith, didn't you?
Oh, yes, we did, didn't we?
But somebody said you stole the show.
Ah, that's not difficult with Madame Arcati.
One critic wrote that you wore black boots, a black beret, and a kind of personalised tent.
I've never really understood why the laugh came so enormous, but I wore ankle socks, and as I came from behind the chair and they saw the ankle socks, the audience just fell about with laughter, and I can't think why. But once I got the laugh, I always wore the socks, of course.
When was it, though, Peggy, going back again to the early days, that you came to terms with not being glamorous? How old were you when you realised you had to settle for what nature
I can see up? I know I was in Leeds, in the theatre in Leeds, and I was eating my apple. And Geoffrey Wood, who was the company manager, he was the director and ran the company, said to me, why aren't you having your lunch? And I said, I want to get thin so that I can play all the glamour parts. And he said to me, You've got a character face, a character body, a character walk, and you'll never be anything but a character woman, so eat. And he walked away. And I cried my eyes out, I remember. But I very, very soon realised that he was absolutely right. And I gave up all ideas of ever being glamorous, and I played all the character parts, and I was then very successful.
Tell me about your next record.
One of my dear friends, Dorothy Squires, wrote and made a big success of a wonderful number, Say It With Flowers, and with dear Russ Conway playing the piano. She was promoting the record, and she invited us all down to her home, and she had a swimming pool, and we were all to dive in the swimming pool and have photographs taken, because nobody realised how cold the water was. And with all the press around taking photographs, everybody dived in this water and came up, so the photographs are really quite something.
When you want to say, don't worry, say it with flowers.
Dorothy Squires, accompanied by Russ Conway, and Say It With Flowers. So years of rep, Peggy, pre and post-war, but it was in 1955, wasn't it?
Yes.
In your late 30s, you're in London, running out of money, and you were offered the part of a lifetime. Emma Hornet in Sailor Beware. Tell me about it.
Well, I was in one room in Bayswater, and my agent said to me, you know, he'd got this play down in Worthing, and he thought I could play it. And I said to him, I've got to do it. Nobody could do it better than I can. And it was cast. And, you know, I thought, oh. And then he phoned me up on the Friday, and he said the lady who was going to play the part had been called back on a film, and they'd got first call on her. Would I do it? So I got the script, and I stayed up all Friday night, all Saturday night, and all Sunday night, and I learnt it. Because you get out of learning weekly rep. And I went down to Worthing, and it was a huge success. And Jack Waller bought it and wanted to bring it into the West End. And it was a year. I had a whole year out of work, more or less, because I daren't take another job in case we got a theatre.
Because you knew it was your part.
I knew it was my part.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, again, a critic has said since that occasionally you get this absolute coincidence of role and performer, and it was your part, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely.
Tell me about her, Emma Hornet. What was she like?
Well, again, she was a Cockney woman with a daughter. And the daughter gets herself engaged to be married to a sailor. And Mum has had Dad, and all he's interested in is his ferrets in the back garden. And she had to do all the work and all the thinking. And my daughter is not going to have that. And that's why she was so awfully evil to the sailor, because she didn't think he was good enough for her daughter. The dialogue in that play was unbelievable. I'd love to do it again.
But it was a huge hit. I mean, it was an overnight success at the Strand Theatre, wasn't it?
It was absolutely unbelievable. What was also incredible, I didn't see it, I didn't know it, but they had put my name outside the theatre in lights and hadn't lit it up, because Jack Waller was sure I was going to be a big success. And I came happily round the corner the next day, and I looked up, and there was my name in lights. And I shot into a doorway, a glove shop, I remember, and I was looking. I thought, that's my name. And it was bigger than anybody's, in lights.
So is that really your favourite part of all time, really, Emma Hornet?
Well, yes, I've got to say that, haven't I? I mean, I've played some wonderful parts, but Emma Hornet will always be my favourite, because she gave me everything I wanted in the world.
Record number 5.
Another favourite of mine that I've loved all my life is Judy Garland, particularly that lovely number, You Made Me Love You.
And I thought I'd write and tell you so. You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. You made love you. And all the time you knew it, I guess you always knew it. You made me happy sometimes.
Judy Garland and You Made Me Love You. You made films too, of course, Peggy, notably Hotel Paradiso.
Oh, yes, with beloved Alec Guinness, yes.
Were you very much in awe of the great man?
I was more than in awe. And my very, very first encounter with him, it was in Paris, and I had to stick a hat pin up his bottom in the action. And they gave me this hat pin that was absolutely lethal. I mean, it was sharp as anything. And I can't speak French, and they couldn't speak English. And I was trying to get it rubbed down, and I never
blunted.
Did. And I'm doing the scene, and of course I didn't stick it in him. And he said to me rather grandly, you know, you will have to stick that in me. And I said to him, no, if you want that up your ass, you're welcome. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and we both fell about with laughter. And I discovered after that he was more afraid of me than I was of him. But he was so wonderful to work with. I loved him dearly.
And then there was Sid James, of course, another co-star of yours.
Lovely man.
On the television, that was, wasn't
it?
Yes, George and the Dragon.
We did 3 or 4 years together, Sid and I, and we never had a crossword. He was so wonderful to work with. It was the very, very first day with him. We were live television. And he leant across and moved me. And I'd stood right in front of his camera. He wasn't cross. He thought, oh, dear, silly woman. But he was wonderful.
But what you certainly seemed to manage to do was steer this very clever line, really, between television and the theatre, because you never quite got swallowed up by the television, did you? Despite the sitcoms, which does happen
because
to a lot
my
of people.
First love is the theatre.
But I suppose you would have made far more money in the television and in commercials and so on.
Very much so, yes. I was far more interested in the parts always and the playing of it than the money.
But you've made enough in your time.
Oh, yes, I'm not complaining about that. But I had a wonderful agent who was a great influence in my life. And he once said to me, let's make our money in the television and keep the theatre alive, eh, Peg? And that is something that we've all got to remember now, because the theatre's going through a bad time, and we mustn't ask for £125,000 a week. You know, we've got to go and keep the theatre alive.
Tell me about your next record.
When I had the privilege of playing the nurse in Romeo and Juliet, I was sitting in the audience waiting to go on, and there was an Italian sitting next to me with an instrument, I don't know what it was, and he was picking out a tune. And that tune went right the way through the play, right the way through the film, and to my absolute amazement, one day I heard Johnny Mathis singing it, and it was one of the Top of the Pops.
And with our love, through tears and thorns, we will endure as we pass surely through every storm. A time for us, someday there'll be a new world, a world of shining hope for you and me.
Johnny Mathis singing A Time for Us, the love theme from the film of Romeo and Juliet. Do you remember Peggy being booked to play the part at the Old Vic?
Well, yes, indeed. I had been offered every tough old lady that there ever was, and I turned it all down, and the phone rang and a voice said, my name is Michael Bentall. And I thought, I ought to know that name, I ought to know that. And he said, I run the Old Vic and we are doing Romeo and Juliet, would you? And I said, yes, please. And he said, oh my, that was quick. And I said, but you're an answer to prayer. He said, I've been called a lot of things in my time, but never an answer to prayer.
You've never married, Peggy?
No, I've had one or two wonderful experiences, and I don't know, sometimes I think...
Perhaps all those men thought you were the battle axe you were on
It
stage.
Could be. That had never occurred to me, of course. Never occurred to
but
me.
But maybe also, is it perhaps that you come from that generation of women who feel that they had to make a choice between marriage and a career? Do you
think I do. I mean, I think myself, I mean, I mustn't keep on about it, but I do think my mother's the loveless of my mother probably did have a lot to do with it. I mean, I say it hadn't affected me. It hasn't altered my life. I've had the most wonderful life, and I'm terribly grateful for it. But certainly when I was a child and I had no love at all from my mother, I think maybe that did affect me.
Mm.
But I don't regret it. I'm not the slightest bit sour or bitter about it at all.
You don't sound it at all.
No, I'm not. I've had the most wonderful life, and I had the most wonderful childhood.
And what about the other thing that you talked about in your early life, the weight? Have you gone on waging a lifelong battle against it, or did you give up?
Now I don't even think about it, but then I wouldn't at my age, would I?
And anyway, on a desert island, you can be and do exactly what you like. I mean, are you looking forward to it? How will you pass the time when you get there?
I'm one of those people, I can be solitary. I'm quite happy by myself, you know, and now, of course, if I get lonely, I can pick up the phone and I've got hundreds of friends. But that wouldn't happen on a desert island. But I could cope.
Right, record number 7.
This is a very special record for me because it was the music was by Cyril Ornadell, and my dear friend Norman Newell wrote the lyrics. And while they were creating this, I was making them cups of tea and cups of coffee. And so I was there when this lovely record was conceived. And, of course, it was a huge success for Matt Munro, Portrait of My Love.
It would take, I know, a Michelangelo, and he would need the glow of dawn that paints the sky above, to try and paint a portrait of my love.
Matt Munro and Portrait of My Love. You're still in work, Peggy, very much so, but you don't see as well as you did.
No, unfortunately, I've got a detached retina, and that's, you know, what happens. Something happens to you when you get old, and that's what's happened to me. But I can see on the stage. As long as I know where everything is, I'm perfectly all right.
But how do you learn your lines, then?
On tape. That's not easy. I've got a very, very dear friend who puts everything on tape for me, and I learn on tape. It's ever so much easier when you can see when you're learning and you dry and you can just look at it. But
Your mind's eye on the page, yes, as it were. It's a sort of photographic thing.
It's not. A lot of people have always learnt on tape. But I suppose what you first learn, it's much easier for you.
Mm. So is it quite worrying walking on stage and not...
No. Once I know what I'm saying, once I've learnt the words properly, I've got no problem. So because I can see. I mean, I'm not blind. I'm what they call half-sighted. And people are so kind. You've only got to appeal to somebody and say, I'm half-sighted, will you help me? And everybody will help you.
Mm.
I mean, there's far more kindness in this world than we're giving it credit for.
You're just 80. What are you currently doing? You're about to play in Uncle Vanya, right?
Yes, I'm doing Uncle Vanya down at Chichester.
Your nanny?
I'm playing nanny, yes. I've learnt it.
Again, a wonderful part.
Oh, it is. It's lovely. There's not a bad part in it, actually. It's a very, very well-written play, of course, Uncle Vanya.
And do you still enjoy it, then? Does it still give you the buzz you were describing earlier?
You never lose it. Even when you play something like pantomime, I usually play Fairy Godmother. And when you go out and those children respond to you, I mean, there's nothing like it in the world.
You said before now that you planned to die on the stage. Very dramatic exit. Is that really what you'd like to have?
Oh, no. I mean, you say these things. I mean, I don't want ever to retire because I love working so much. And if they want me, as long as they want me, I will be only too pleased to play.
Tell me about your last record.
Well, my one classical record, actually, good gracious. I was at home one night and Norman, my lovely friend Norman, phoned me up and said, I've got to go to Paris, Peg, and I've got 2 tickets for the ballet. Would you like them? So I went and got them. What I didn't realise was it was the first night of Romeo and Juliet with Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn, and it was one of the most wonderful evenings of my life. Everybody, of course, was there, but I'd just done Romeo and Juliet, and I could hear the dialogue. It was so marvellous. I mean, they were absolutely superb, and it was the Prokofiev, and that will always be close to my heart.
Part of Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, played by the Bolshoi Theatre Orchestra, conducted by Algis Juraitis. So if you could only take one of those records, Peggy, which one would it be?
There's no doubt in my mind. I'd have to have Portrait of My Love, because then I would have Norman and Cyril with me making wonderful music all the time.
And what about a book?
I thought Dear Beloved Noel Card's Diaries. Everything I've ever done of Card's has been wonderful, and it'll be lovely to have him with me on the island.
And what about your luxury?
Lots and lots of tea. I can do anything as long as I've got a cup of tea.
Peggy Mount, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.